So tonight's Dharma talk is the second in a series of three, talking about Brené Brown's model, how to cultivate meaningful, authentic relationships. And she divides the skills into three buckets: grounded confidence, the courage to walk beside, and story stewardship. So last week I talked about grounded confidence. Next week I'll be talking about story stewardship. Tonight I'm going to talk about the courage to walk alongside. And I really like the way she frames this, the courage to walk alongside, because I think it's true that in any friendship or romantic relationship that continues for decades, it's going to be the case that one or both of the people go through some stuff that's really hard. Whether it's health challenges or job troubles or crime or disasters, you know. Life is difficult, you know, and it can be a difficult thing to remain in connection with somebody when they're going through challenges. It takes a lot of courage to do that. I know in my case that with ALS, you know, so many of my friends have remained connected to me, and not the easiest thing, I realize, you know, for my friends and my family to witness what I'm going through, but so many have continued to remain connected to me, which is so meaningful to me, you know. And so I just like the way that she frames it as the courage to walk alongside. She identified seven skills or seven areas, and then I added one more that I thought was implicit. So the first thing that she says that is part of courage to walk alongside is setting and respecting boundaries. And boundaries are very important. I think we live in a culture in which there's a widespread incidence of very poor boundaries and lots of codependent behavior. So what do boundaries look like? Well, boundaries are controlled by the third chakra, the solar plexus chakra. And one very good way to think about this chakra is to think about the physical organs that are there, the digestive organs. Fundamentally, digestion is the miraculous process by which not me becomes me. That's what's happening in digestion. So, you know, I eat plants and animals, I eat a bunch of stuff that's not me, and my body has some way of breaking that down, turning it into me, turning it into my body, turning it into my energy. And there's an incredible intelligence there that's just operating that knows exactly, okay, this is a nutrient, let's absorb this. This is a nutrient, let's absorb this. This is waste, we don't need that. And then the waste just passes through, you know? An incredible intelligence in what to assimilate and what not to assimilate, you know? And our bodies just do that automatically. So for the third chakra, think about the analogous process with emotional energies. We all live in a society where there are tons of emotional energies coming at us. Friends and expectations of people we know, things acquaintances say, societal expectations, certainly advertising and images in the media, social media, all these emotional messages about you should be this kind of person, you shouldn't be that kind of person, you should do this, you should say this, you should wear this, you shouldn't think that, you know. Etc., etc. Someone with very good boundaries would be able to say, okay, that message, that resonates with who I am, I'm going to assimilate that. That message, that doesn't feel good, I'm just going to let that pass. You know, so the analogous process to digestion. And if we're trying to develop good boundaries, one thing that's very good is just to pay attention to our gut sense of things. You know, when we're talking with any person, in any conversation, in any situation, how does it feel at a gut level? And what is our gut telling us, you know? And I know in my own case, when I was first developing boundaries, I'd get that gut sense, but sometimes it'd be inconvenient. And then my head would talk myself out of it, you know? It's gonna be all right. It's gonna be fine, you know? And then later looking back, I'd realize, I really should have listened to my gut, you know? So part of the challenge of listening to your gut is actually trusting it. And actually, especially when it gives you advice that doesn't seem to work logically or doesn't seem convenient, trusting that your gut really is telling you something valuable. That's part of boundaries. And part of boundaries also is just self-love and self-compassion. You know, like in other words, I have to value myself in order to realize I should be protected from these bad things. You know, I don't deserve to be treated in such and such a way. You know, so, and self-compassion is really one of the aspects of grounded confidence. So many of the skills of grounded confidence are very important in the courage to walk beside. So, and she frames it as getting and respecting boundaries, you know, and obviously the more clear we are about our own boundaries, the more we tend to be clear about other people's boundaries. You know, if I'm not valuing my own boundaries, then it's hard to respect somebody else's boundaries, you know. So very important just to consider, you know, how are our boundaries? Do I respect boundaries? You know, these are good questions for all of us. Do I have good boundaries? When do I have good boundaries? When do I not have good boundaries? You know. Related to boundaries, this is the only one that Brené Brown didn't say. I'm introducing this idea. Emotional sovereignty. This seems like something implicit in what Brené Brown was saying. Emotional sovereignty is the idea that I am 100% responsible for everything I feel, you know? And in order to talk about emotional sovereignty, I want to talk for a moment about blame. And the funny thing about blame is ultimately there's no healing in blame. But there are situations in which I could see it might be a positive. And here's what I mean. You know, if someone had been in a position where they've had very poor boundaries and they've been abused or manipulated for a long time, and then they're getting to the point where they're starting to realize that they can stand up for themselves. They can say, I don't deserve this. I don't want to take this anymore. I need you to stop doing this or I'm going to leave, you know. They're able to start standing up for themselves. Blame might be an important part of that empowerment, of that crossing over from being just a total passive victim to starting to claim their power, you know. And so I want to name that there is a stage in which blame might be something helpful. I'll hasten to say, though, that once we get to the place that we do feel empowered, that, you know, we're not going to tolerate anyone treating us badly, you know, once we're at that point, blame doesn't serve us anymore. There's no healing in blame. Healing only comes through self-responsibility. And so emotional sovereignty is taking full responsibility for everything I feel. From the point of view of emotional responsibility, if somebody else says or does something and then I get mad, that's my energy, that's my anger to deal with. You know, that's my stuff, you know. And as I investigate it, I may realize that there's something off about what the other person did, and maybe I should, you know, talk with them also. But it's primarily taking responsibility for what I feel. And I will say in my own life, 9 out of 10 times, if something makes me mad, what I realize after with very little introspection is that, you know, what the other person did was just a mild annoyance, but it's tapping into some deeper early childhood stuff, you know, which clearly is all mine, you know, that kind of thing. And one important thing about emotional sovereignty is, if I'm really in a place of emotional sovereignty, that means that as I'm going around in life, I'm not dumping the responsibility for my emotions onto the people around me, you know? And so emotional sovereignty can be very important, certainly in a friendship and even in an intimate relationship. And emotional sovereignty is totally consistent with being vulnerable and being touched by others and, you know, all, you know, feeling things deeply. All that is part of emotional sovereignty. But I'm not making anyone else responsible for what I feel, you know. The next quality that Brené Brown talks about is being non-judgmental. And this one is very tricky, because I think we all know people who are very judgmental, who walk around, you know, blasting judgments about all kinds of things, you know. And of course, we're not like that. So we get to say that we're non-judgmental because we're not like that. But it's very funny. In a deep friendship or in a romantic relationship, if there's a moment when one partner is speaking vulnerably about something in their process, sharing a story from their history, sharing something about what they're feeling, if they're sharing something deep and raw, and then when, as I'm listening, if I'm triggered, that means my capacity has been overwhelmed, you know. If I'm triggered, then I'm no longer fully present to them. And so that is felt as an abandonment and as a judgment, you know. So that's a very tricky thing, you know, and especially if someone is processing an early childhood wound where they have experienced abandonment, and then they're telling me about it and I'm triggered, and then they re-experience abandonment, it's almost a re-wounding, you know. And so again, this points to how tremendously important capacity is, you know, and really all of us are responsible for working on our capacity, you know, because the more capacity I can have, the more I can be present to anyone else so that they can process whatever they need to process, you know. And so, again, a very tricky thing about judgment, you know, none of us are consciously deciding to judge, but there's times if it's an emotionally intimate moment and then I'm triggered, that can be experienced as a judgment, you know. So that's a very tricky thing. The next one is, she frames it as power with and power to. You know, power to means empowering somebody else, lifting them up. You can do this. Power with is very similar, but it's more cooperative. We can do this, you know. There are some tasks in life that are naturally cooperative, and there are other things in life that are naturally, you know, things that somebody has to do for themselves. But in both cases, power to and power with are supporting them. And there's actually recently some wonderful examples in pop culture. So, as you probably know, Beyoncé recently released an album. And before it was released, especially, it was billed in part as a country album. And apparently the album is actually kind of a mix of many different styles, but it was billed as a country album. And a lot of conservative backlash against this album even before it came out, you know, with people saying, you know, essentially, you know, country music belongs to white men, like, why is this black woman making a country album, you know? And one of the country songs on the album is a cover of Jolene, a Dolly Parton song. So Dolly Parton came out very strong. She actually appeared with Beyoncé, you know, and she totally supported her. You know, this icon of country music, Dolly Parton, said, you know, it's wonderful that Beyoncé has done this song and her song is a great version. And another song on the album is a cover of the Beatles song, Blackbird, which is a song that Paul McCartney did as an acoustic solo on the White Album. And from England, Sir Paul McCartney put out this enthusiastic statement. He thinks it's wonderful that Beyoncé did this cover, and he said everyone should listen to it. It's a great version of the song, you know? And so with both of those individuals, Dolly Parton and Paul McCartney, Dolly Parton probably, I mean, she could have said something positive, like generally positive. She didn't have to be that enthusiastic, but she chose to be enthusiastic and supportive. And Paul McCartney probably didn't need to say anything, but he went out of his way to be enthusiastic and supportive, you know? And there's something so emblematic about the culture of love in that behavior, you know? The culture of love is about reaching out and supporting others, you know? That when we're in a place of grounded confidence, when we're connected to ourselves, then it feels good to empower others, you know? And so empowerment is very much part of culture of the courage to walk alongside, you know, because how can I say, it's not on the quote sheet, but one of my favorite quotes is the Marianne Williamson quote, "Our deepest fear is not that we're inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we're powerful beyond measure," you know? And it is our deepest fear in many ways. And all of us need reminders to step more into our power, you know? And so the best friends and the best lovers are the ones that are able to remind us in 1,000 different ways, here's how you step into a larger version of yourself, you know? The next one on her list is empathy. And empathy, of course, empathy is mirroring, empathy is feeling deeply into what the other person is saying, you know, trying to feel into what their experiences is like, you know. And a very important thing about empathy, with empathy, it's very important to have good boundaries, and it's very important to have a clear sense of self, again, grounded confidence. I'll tell of a wonderful example of this, the Dalai Lama. So this is a few years ago that a team of Western scientists went and met with the Dalai Lama. And they had a conference over the course of the week about how wisdom, you know, of Tibetan Buddhism might be tested in laboratory conditions, how, you know, what we might learn, you know. And so there were a number of scientists there, and one of them was Paul Ekman, who is one of the world's authorities on the facial display of human emotion. And so they were talking with the Dalai Lama, but of course part of the Dalai Lama's day is that there are always pilgrims. There's always lines of pilgrims waiting to see the Dalai Lama, you know. And so the Dalai Lama spends a few hours every day meeting and talking with these pilgrims. And some of them are refugees from China, you know, and some of them have just these horrific stories. You know, they crossed the Himalayas and 3 of their family members died during the trip. And, you know, it was this incredibly tragic crossing, you know. And as they're telling this story to the Dalai Lama, you know, their faces would just be racked with grief and pain and sorrow. And Paul Ekman was watching, the Dalai Lama's face would be mirroring them entirely. His face would be racked with grief and pain and sorrow as he was listening to them, you know? He was totally with them. But then, of course, he's done seeing all the pilgrims, and then he goes back to, you know, beaming his radiant smile again, you know? In other words, he's able to be that deeply with people and yet not lose track of who he is, you know? And that's the ideal of empathy, to feel deeply into what the other person is feeling, to mirror them. Often it's, you know, asking the questions that draw out the deeper aspects of what they're feeling. That's part of empathy. But not losing who I am in them. You know, that's an important part for empathy. The next quality is committing to other focus. And this also is a tricky one, and I love the fact she frames it as committing, you know, because we all have moments when we can be other focused, you know, at our best, you know, we can put ourselves aside and be present to another person. You know, many times we do this in our professional lives, for example, you know, but committing to it, you know. Committing to it, commitment means all the time. That's what commitment means. You know, commitment means 24/7, all the time. And so can I remain other focused when I'm mad, when I'm sad, when I'm upset, when I'm disappointed? Can I still remain other focused? You know, because the tendency with all those emotions is to go into self-pity, go into poor me, you know, where I'm no longer connected to the other person. You know, can I really remain connected? Can I really remain, you know, hold a place in myself where I'm still aware of the other person and aware of how what I'm going through is impacting them, even as I'm feeling my own emotion? And again, this takes tremendous capacity, to be able to remain other focused as I'm going through my own deep process, you know. The next one that she cites is being relational. And this is interesting because it's not just about thinking about the other person themselves, but it's also about thinking about the relationship, thinking about almost logistically, you know, how are we communicating? You know, what are the conversations we're having? What are the conversations we're not having? You know, thinking about the health of the relationship. How much time are we spending together? You know, do we have enough together time? Do we have enough apart time? You know, all of those are important questions. Thinking about all the factors that make the relationship more or less successful. You know, what are the subtle but long-term patterns that are developing that might go to a bad place if it just continues unchecked? You know, all those are important considerations when we're thinking about the health of the relationship. You know, so being relational, not just thinking about me and the other person, but also thinking about the relationship itself. How healthy is this thing and what would make it healthier, you know? And of course, finally, compassion. Compassion is just so incredibly important. Compassion for ourselves, compassion for the other person, you know? And how can I say? It's often true in life that the most harm done is done by people in pain. You know, and even in a long-term friendship or a long-term romantic relationship, when it hits a rough patch, when people are angry, you know, even if that friend or lover says something to us that's angry and hurtful in the moment, that's coming from a place of pain, you know? And it can be hard in that moment, you know, when we've just been insulted or something like that, it can be hard to have that compassion. But maybe even if we circle around the next day, to having compassion, even for the way that our friend or our lover hurts us, you know, because if they hurt us, it's coming from a place of pain. And so, you know, how can I say, in Buddhism, they call compassion one of the illimitable minds, one of the mind states without limit, because there's really no end to compassion. There's no end to how deeply we can feel compassion for ourselves, for others, you know? And ultimately, compassion is something that takes us beyond even the limits of ego, you know? So compassion is profoundly important. So at this point, I'll share the quote sheet. Quote sheet is in the chat now. At the top, I have the three principles of Brené Brown's Cultivating Meaningful Connection. Then the various parts of the elements of Courage to Walk Alongside. And then a quote from the Upada Sutra. The Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, to the Buddha, "This is half of the holy life, Lord. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship." And then the Buddha responded to him, "Don't say that, Ananda. Don't say that. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship is actually the whole of the holy life. When a monk has admirable people as friends, companions, and comrades, he can be expected to develop and pursue the Noble Eightfold Path." You know? And so this wonderful message from Buddhism, and really it's in all the wisdom traditions, that connection is so important. Connection is what it's all about. And the more that I can have meaningful, authentic connections with others, the healthier and happier my own life will be as well. So Leonardo da Vinci just shares with us, "Reprove your friend in secret and praise him in open." St. Teresa of Avila just says quite simply, "Love alone gives value to all things." Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "The glory of friendship is not the outstretched hand, nor the kindly smile, nor the joys of companionship. It is the spiritual inspiration that comes when one to one when he discovers that someone else believes in him and is willing to trust him with his friendship." A long quote from the poet Rilke. "The point of a good marriage is not to create a quick commonality by tearing down all boundaries. On the contrary, a good marriage is one in which each partner appoints the other to be the guardian of his solitude. And thus they show each other the greatest possible trust. A merging of two people is an impossibility, and where it seems to exist, it is a hemming in, a mutual consent that robs one party or both party of their fullest freedom and development. But once the realization is accepted that even between the closest people, infinite distances exist, a marvelous living side by side can grow up for them, if they succeed in loving the expanse between them, which gives them the possibility of always seeing each other as whole and before an immense sky." There's a lot in that quote I like. Carl Jung said quite simply, "The meeting of two personalities is like the contact of two chemical substances. If there is any reaction, both are transformed." Hazrat Inayat Khan said, "The person who alone has seen something beautiful, who has heard something harmonious, has tasted something delicious, has smelled something fragrant, may have enjoyed it, but not completely. The complete joy is in sharing one's joy with others. Catherine Mansfield said, I have always felt that the great high privilege, relief, and comfort of friendship was that one had nothing to explain. Groucho Marx said, when you're in jail, a good friend will be trying to bail you out. A best friend will be in the cell next to you saying, damn, that was fun. I love that one. Power to and power with. Carfried Graf Durkheim said, the man who, being really on the way, falls upon hard times in the world will not, as a consequence, turn to that friend who offers him refuge and comfort and encourages his old self to survive. Rather, he will seek out someone who will faithfully and inexorably help him to risk himself so that he may endure the suffering and pass courageously through it. Only to the extent that man exposes himself over and over to annihilation can that which is indestructible arise within him. In this lies the dignity of daring. A very touching one from Anais Nin. Each friend represents a world in us, a world possibly not born until they arrive, and it is only by this meeting that this new world is born. William Arthur Ward said, a true friend knows your weakness, but shows you your strength, feels your fears, but fortifies your faith, sees your anxieties, but frees your spirit, recognizes your disability, but emphasizes your possibilities. Novelist Milan Kundera said, unlike the puerile loyalty of conviction, loyalty to a friend is a virtue, perhaps the only virtue, the last remaining one. Billionaire Warren Buffett said, the difference between successful people and really successful people is that the really successful people say no to almost everything. Susan Forward, in a book entitled Toxic Parents, says, children who are not encouraged to do, to try, to explore, to master, and to risk failure often feel helpless and inadequate. Overcontrolled by anxious, fearful parents, these children often become anxious and fearful themselves. This makes it difficult for them to mature. Many never outgrow the need for ongoing parental guidance and control. As a result, their parents continue to invade, manipulate, and frequently dominate their lives. Ram Dass said, the heart surrenders everything to the moment. The mind judges and holds back. The nun Joan Chittister said, acceptance is the universal currency of real friendship. It does not warp or shape or wrench a person to be anything other than what they are. The author Rachel Naomi Raymond said, the most basic and powerful way to connect with another person is to listen. Just listen. Perhaps the most important thing that we can ever give each other is our attention. A loving silence often has far more power to heal and to connect than the most well-intentioned words. Couple from Wayne Dyer. He said, when you judge another, you do not define them, you define yourself. He also said, friends are God's way of apologizing for your family. Mary Rose O'Reilly said, attention, deep listening. People are dying in spirit for lack of it. In academic culture, most listening is critical listening. We tend to pay attention only long enough to develop a counter-argument. We critique the student or the colleague's idea, we mentally grade and pigeonhole each other. In society at large, people often listen with an agenda, to sell or petition or seduce. Seldom is there a deep, open-hearted, non-judgmental reception of the other. And so we all talk louder and more stridently and with a terrible desperation. By contrast, if someone truly listens to me, my spirit begins to expand. Jack Kornfield said, "Peace requires us to surrender our illusion of control. We can love and care for others, but we cannot possess our children, lovers, family, or friends. We can assist them, pray for them, wish them well, yet in the end, their happiness and suffering depends on their thought and actions, not on our wishes." A line from a Crosby, Stills, and Nash song written by Stephen Stills, "I am yours, you are mine, you are what you are." And I just love the way that it balances two people belonging to each other, but not losing the fact that each one is authentically themselves, you know? Norman Fisher said, "Real empathy requires that we develop the capacity to put our own concerns aside long enough to notice what someone else is going through internally without reference to ourselves." Bell Hooks, that astonishing woman, said, "Honesty and openness is always the foundation of insightful dialogue." Anne Lamott says quite simply, "No is a complete sentence." Gary Moore said, "A friend is someone who walks into the room when everyone else is walking out." David White said, "I often talk about the conversational nature of reality, the fact that whatever you think you are never survives meeting anything other than you. And anyone in an intimate relationship knows that whoever you woke with in the morning does not survive that first conversation in the kitchen with your spouse or loved one or partner. You're into something that's more frontier, something that quite often disturbs you, subverts you, and is almost always asking you to be bigger than yourself." Tony Robbins says quite simply, "You get what you tolerate." Excuse me, I have to get some water. Brené Brown says, "Compassionate people ask for what they need. They say no when they need to, and when they say yes, they mean it. They're compassionate because their boundary keeps them out of resentment." That's a great question. It's a great question about boundaries. How much do we own our yes? How much do we own our no? When we say yes, is it really a hell yes? Or is it a I'm saying yes to be polite because I think that's what you want, you know, that kind of thing. Zadie Smith said, "Stop worrying about your identity and concern yourself with the people you care about, ideas that matter to you, beliefs you can stand by, tickets you can run on." Leslie Jameson said, "Empathy isn't just listening. It's asking the questions whose answers need to be listened to. Empathy requires inquiry as much as imagination. Empathy requires that you know nothing. Empathy means acknowledging a horizon of context that extends perpetually beyond what you can see." Danny Silk said, "In order for us to practice self-control, we must have a goal. We must have something we are saying yes to, which necessarily comes with things that we must say no to. We use our self-control to maneuver ourselves toward this yes. The goal must be entirely our own. The minute another person is choosing and managing our goals for us, we have left self-control behind." Kevin Donaldson said, "Remember, no one has the right to control your emotions, thoughts, and actions unless you let them." George Alexiou said quite simply, friendship is thinking of the other person first. Shannon Alder said, the only real conflict you will ever have in your life won't be with others, but with yourself. And then a great anonymous quote, the only people who get upset about you setting boundaries are the ones who are benefiting from you not having any.